Well, dear brethren, this topic is one that is special for this convention, but I'm not going to tell you why until the close, at which point I think most of you will say, I didn't know that, and be a little surprised. But of course, the topic of loving your enemies is always one that we need to keep before our minds. And today's talk is going to deal with some practical issues on loving your enemies. Our text, of course, comes from our Master himself when he was speaking the Beatitudes. So let's turn together to that fifth chapter of Matthew to read this. Focus our minds on it. And I'd like to start with the 43rd verse. You have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love them which love you, what reward do you have? Don't even the publicans do the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what are you doing more than others? Do not even the publicans do so? Be ye therefore perfect. And remember, brethren, that word perfect doesn't mean that we will have the sort of mental state and moral standing before God that Adam had. This word perfect here, teleos, is tied in with the thought of maturity, or as Brother Dan Wessel's talk would have said, this is the ones that have reached the summer of their lifetimes. So be mature as your Father, which in heaven is mature. And probably no admonition of Jesus has been more difficult to follow than this command to love your enemies. Some men fail that it actually is not practical. It's simply not possible to do that. It's easy, they say, to love those who love you. But really, how can you love those who openly and insidiously seek to destroy you? Others contend that Jesus' exhortation to love one's enemies really is a testimony to the fact that the Christian ethic is designed for the weak, for the cowardly, not for the strong and courageous. Jesus, they say, was an impractical idealist, and in spite of insistent questions and persistent objections like this, this command of Jesus challenges us with a new urgency. Upheaval after upheaval reminds us that modern man is traveling on a road that is not the highway of holiness. It's the broad way to destruction. It's a road called hate, in a journey that'll bring this present order to destruction and judgment. Far from this command of our Lord to love your enemies being the pious injunction of a utopian dreamer, this command to love your enemies is an absolute necessity for the survival of the meek in the day of the Lord's vengeance. And we read this in Zephaniah. Let's just turn together to Zephaniah 2:3. Seek ye the Lord, all ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his judgment. Seek righteousness, seek meekness. It may be that ye shall be hid in the day of the Lord's anger. Well, brethren, Jesus was not an impractical idealist. He was a practical realist. We can be certain that Jesus understood the inherent difficulty in this act of loving one's enemy. He realized that every genuine expression of love grows out of a consistent and a total surrender to God. When Jesus said, "Love your enemies," he wasn't unmindful of the stringent qualities. He meant every word of it. Our responsibility as Christians is to seek with a passion to live it out in our daily lives, to preach it in a world that needs to learn of God's gracious love. But before we love our enemies, there's a few steps. And I think all of us have been through those studies in the 7th chapter of volume 6 on the quatermarks of love, the four quatermarks. The four quatermarks. Okay, I hope that's not on the camera. The four quatermarks of love. we have to love each other first. And it gets down to some practical issues. So let's ask the question, how do we love our enemies? First, we must develop and maintain a capacity to forgive. He who's devoid of this power to forgive is devoid also of the power to love. It is impossible even to begin this act of loving one's enemies without a prior acceptance of the necessity over and over again to forgive those who inflict evil and injury upon us. It's also necessary to realize that the forgiving act must be initiated by the person who's been wronged. The forgiving act has to be initiated by the person who's wronged, the victim of some great hurt, the recipient of some torturous injustice, the absorber of some terrible act of oppression. The wrongdoer may request forgiveness. He may come to himself and, like the prodigal son, move up some dusty road, his heart palpitating with this desire for forgiveness. But only the injured neighbor, the loving father back home, can really pour out these warm waters of forgiveness. And forgiveness does not mean ignoring what has been done or putting a false label on it. It's an evil act that happened. It means, rather, that this evil act no longer remains as a barrier, as a wall to a relationship. So forgiveness is a catalyst creating the atmosphere necessary for a fresh start and a new beginning. And before we leave this picture, you know, we were talking about how we need to love one another, and we're going to get into the various words for love, but the one that is the love a brother has for a brother is the filial love. And we're showing here a Holocaust survivor who's taking the experiences, the horrible experiences as a child he had, and he's trying to make sure he's sharing it at a public school with the young children so that they will remember that this really happened. It's not just in the books. And in fact, my first exposure to a Holocaust survivor, like not a survivor, but somebody who dealt with it, was the principal of my high school, Mr. Galvin, who was not Jewish, but he was part of the Allied forces who went to liberate Buchenwald. And he said that never, he said it, that changed his life. That changed his life. And while we're on this, I want to tell a little story about a practical application of what Jesus meant when he said, "No greater love does a man have than to give his life for his friend." So this is one of the survivor stories. There's actually a whole program to try to record these survivor stories before the generation. Now, he was a young child when he received the tattoo at the death camp, but to try to record these memories on video so that they can be passed along as historic archives. And we were in Orlando at the Holocaust Museum there with Brother Dan Wessel's mother. I think many of you know, but Brother Dan's father is the little brother to Sister Sue's mother. Okay, so they're cousins, they're first cousins. So we were at the Holocaust Museum, and here was the story. The war was closing out, the Allies were closing in on the death camps, and yet the hate was so great. The decisions were made, what's the most damage we can still do before the Allies will come? And so the decision was, let's get the college-educated, the best-educated ones of the Jews that are still alive and just shoot them. And there were two men who were friends at the camp. One of them was a tailor who was, his physical frame was not very good. He'd survived that long, but he had developed a friendship with a man who was an engineer. And they had this love for each other. And he was aware of what was going to happen, and he said to his friend who was the engineer, "I will take your place," because things were moving along. They weren't going to check over the numbers and everything. They were just looking, they called out a number, and then you reported to the company. And so he took the place of his friend, who was younger and able-bodied. And the group that was going to be executed were standing in the graves, facing the firing squad. And it turned out that the officer had a problem. He'd lost a button on his coat. And so he said, "Are any of you tailors? Know anything about tailoring?" And of course, this one man, that was his profession. He said, "Yeah, I do." And so he said, "Come out of here. I need you to sew the button on my coat." And he did that, and his life was spared. Now, on the other side, his friend was, still back at the camp, totally unaware of what had happened. And they needed a work squad to be sent out. And he was able-bodied, which his friend wasn't. And so they sent him out on the work squad. And again, his life was spared. After the camp was liberated, to the incredible surprise of both of them, they were both alive. They met each other again. Now, not all, this is a real story. You know, not all stories end happily like that, but this is a story about greater love hath no man than to give his life for his friends. And in this case, can you imagine the joy? And can you imagine the joy that there's going to be when mankind comes together again in the kingdom? But forgiveness is not a matter of not saying it wasn't an evil act that was happening. Forgiveness is the lifting of the burden and canceling the debt. The words, "I forgive you, but I'll never forget what you've done," really don't explain the real nature of forgiveness. Certainly, one can never forget if it means erasing it totally from the mind. But we understand the mind of God. The psalmist sings, "As far as the east is from the west, so far hath he removed our transgressions," and those are the willful sins, "from us." That's found in Psalm 103, verse 12. When we forgive, we forget in a sense that the evil deed is no longer a mental block impeding a new relationship. Likewise, we can never say, "I'll forgive you, but I won't have anything to do with you in the future." Forgiveness means a reconciliation, an at-one-ment, if you will, a coming back together. Without this, no man can love his enemies. To the degree to which we're able to forgive, to that degree, that determines the degree to which we can love our enemies. And as hard as it is to recognize this, we need to recognize that the evil deed of an enemy neighbor, the thing that hurts, really never quite expresses the potential they have to be good, wonderful human beings. That's what God can see. An element of goodness may be found even in our worst enemy. Examples: the Sanhedrin's chief deputy for rounding up and taking care of Christians, Saul, when he gets knocked off his horse by the noonday, the light that's brighter than the noonday sun, and finds out, in a way that, of course, is a direct divine revelation, "You are on the wrong path." And what does he do? Does he say, "I'm going to go back and redo my Sanhedrin and Pharisee studies and get back into..." No, he changes. The Lord could see the potential in this persecuting individual. And some of that won't come out until we're well into the kingdom. In some cases, it may never be possible to change an individual, but when I think of the kingdom, brethren, I think of the difficult challenges they're going to be to ask and to give forgiveness and to learn to develop this love. It's not going to be easy. Oh, you'll say, "Well, everything's going to be so wonderful." I don't think this is going to be easy. Because right now, you know, there's a persistent civil war raging in our lives. Something within us causes us to lament, as the Apostle Paul did, "The good that I would do, I do not. But the evil which I would not, that I do." That's Romans 7:19. So this simply means that there is some good in the worst of us and some evil in the best of us. When we discover this, we're less prone to hate our enemies. When we look beneath just what's happening on the surface, beneath these impulses for evil, and see within our neighbor, enemy, the element of goodness, we know that the viciousness of these acts is not representing what they can be. We see him in a new light. We recognize that his hate grows out of fear, out of pride, out of ignorance, out of prejudice, out of misunderstanding. But in spite of all of this, we know that God's image is ineffably etched in his being. This image is not beyond the gracious provisions of God for mankind in the kingdom. In a practical way, we love our enemies by realizing they are not totally bad and they are not beyond the reach of God's redemptive love. Of course, there are going to be some unhappy exceptions. So you've defeated your enemy, you've gotten them to admit they were wrong, and what would feel better than trying to humiliate them also? But we must not seek to defeat and humiliate our enemy, but to win their friendship and understanding. You know, at times we may be tempted to humiliate our worst enemy, and inevitably, in the weak moments, those will come. You're watching for them, and we may be able to take advantage of that. But we must not do so. Every word and every deed that comes from our mouth must contribute to a better understanding with the enemy and to release those vast reservoirs of goodwill which have been blocked by these impenetrable walls of hate. And the meaning of love is not to be confused with just some sentimental outpouring. Love is something much deeper than emotion. The Greek language has three different words to describe love. And we just want to review those together for a minute so that we can put this into the context. Now, the first word is this word eros. That's the word for physical love. Of course, in Platonic dialogue, eros is a yearning of the soul for the realm of the divine. However, this word eros, when we get our word erotic from it, is not used in the New Testament. Second word, philia. This is the reciprocal love and intimate affection and friendship between friends. And when I saw this picture, it's like, can you doubt these two young boys are anything but closest friends? That word is used in the New Testament. We love those whom we like, and we love because we're loved. And that's good. That's okay. That's philia love. Now, the third word is the word that we find most frequently in the New Testament. That's the Greek word agape. This is the understanding and creative, the redemptive love that has goodwill for all men. And you know, brethren, it's not even just those who have come into a better understanding of the Lord that have this love. We are wired for this because we're in the image of God. And we have this love for men, not because their ways always appeal to us, not even because we recognize they possess some sort of divine spark, but we love every man because God loves him. At this level, we love the person who does an evil deed, although we hate the deed itself. And now we can understand what Jesus meant when he said, love your enemies. When Jesus bids us love our enemies, he's not speaking either of eros or philia love. He's talking about this agape love. This love that has an understanding behind it. This love that's creative. This love that's redemptive. This love that has goodwill for all men. And only by following this way and responding with this type of love are we going to be the children of our Father who is in heaven. So let's move now from, let's say, discussing the practical how to the theoretical question of why. Why should we love our enemies? And the first reason is fairly obvious. Returning hate for hate multiplies hate. Adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness can't drive out darkness. It can't. Only light can drive out darkness. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Hate multiplies hate. Violence multiplies violence. Toughness multiplies toughness. And it's a descending spiral. And that's where the world's at, brethren. That's where the world's at. So when Jesus says, love your enemies, he's setting forth a profound and ultimately inescapable admonition. Has the world, the modern world, come to an impasse? Isn't there more urgency than ever to love one's enemies or else? You know, this chain reaction of evil hate begetting hate, wars producing more wars, will remain unbroken. Why? Because the words of Christ aren't being heard. That's why the second psalm says, kiss the Son, you rulers. Kiss the Son. Embrace this if you were going to be spared of judgment. It's not going to happen. Left to itself, this cycle will lead mankind to plunge further and further into the abyss. There's another reason why we should love our enemies. Hate scars us and distorts our personality. You know, hate is an evil and dangerous force. And those who think of what it does when they go and they speak to those who are haters, even, you know, when you look at them, their soul is scarred. That's going to take a lot of work in the kingdom, and it's not going to be easy work to repair that. We've seen the ugly consequences. We already mentioned the 6 million Jews who were annihilated because of the hate-obsessed madman named Hitler. What does Isaiah 19:2 say about our day? Let's just turn together and take a look at that, brethren. I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight everyone against his brother, and every one against his neighbor, city against city, kingdom against kingdom. Yes, we have the testimony of the scriptures of what will happen. This cycle scars and causes anarchy. But there's yet one other side that we can't overlook. If we leave this cancer of hate unchecked, it will corrode our personality and eat away at what we are as human beings. Hate destroys not only our sense of values, but our objectivity and thinking. It's something that blinds us. It causes the hater to say that something which is beautiful is ugly. Something that's ugly is beautiful. Causes the hater to confuse the true with the false, and the false with the true. Prejudice includes documented examples of community where people just weren't normal, amiable and congenial, even though they're normal and amiable and congenial in day-to-day relations with their own kind, when they're challenged with other communities separated by race, language, religion, the hate emerges. And that's what happens when we permit hate to linger in our minds. Many of our inner conflicts are rooted in hate. Hence, there's this saying out there, love or perish. This modern restatement recognizes the principle that Jesus was teaching centuries ago. Hate divides our personality, and love, in contrast, brings everything together in our minds. That's why we've got to do it. There's another reason why we should love our enemies. Love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. You can never get rid of an enemy by meeting hate with hate. Never. By its very nature, hate destroys and tears down. By its very nature, love creates and builds up. Love transforms with redemptive power. And there's an interesting example of this in American history. You know, there was no war in which more deaths and more bloodshed and more hate within families took place than the American Civil War. But President Abraham Lincoln could speak a kind word about the South during the Civil War, when the feelings were most bitter. And he was asked by a shocked bystander, "How could you do that?" And Lincoln said to the lady who asked, "Madam, don't I destroy my enemies when I make them my friends?" Well, this gracious answer is one that bears reflection. Let's take a look. That's ultimately what we want to do. We want to convert our enemies and destroy them, not just annihilate and move them off the scene, but see if we can turn them into our friends. That's how we're going to put into practice these words of our Lord, to love your enemies, that you may be children of your Father which is in heaven. We're called to this difficult task in order to realize that this building up is going to give us a unique relationship with God, because we are the potential sons of God. We want to make that potential an actuality in our lives, brethren. We want to love our enemies because only by loving God can we know God and experience the beauty of His holiness. The relevance of this command from Christ should be readily apparent in the crises of our day. There'll be no permanent solution to the issues of hate facing the world until men develop this capacity to love their enemies. And I like to say in a practical way, if you take a look at what's happening today in Israel, if there is a child on the Palestinian side, or even a soldier, somebody who's injured, they make sure that the injured party gets the care in the hospital to bring them recovery. They're learning this lesson of the Lord and trying to put it into practical terms to see if they can reduce the hate by doing that, realizing that hate only begets hate. And there are some powerful talks that have been on the web about, for instance, the problems that took place over the summer where you just had what you could see a mature character saying, no, if we're going to ever solve this problem, it's going to require us changing a relationship. We can make a determination in our own lives. In fact, you know, we've mentioned the Holocaust and survivors. There is one psychologist who came out of that and developed the school called logotherapy, which says, you know, you can't control external circumstances. You're in the concentration camp. But you have one ultimate freedom, and that's the freedom of what you choose to be the response in your heart. You have a choice. You have a choice. Love your enemies that you may be the children of your Father in heaven. This is a difficult task, but it gives us a unique relationship, a godlike relationship. We have to love our enemies because only by loving them can we really know God and experience the beauty of His holiness. How we long, brethren, for that day when the Lord will turn to the people a pure language, and they will call upon the name of the Lord and serve Him with one consent. Millions have been battered by oppression, frustrated in life day to day, bewildered at night by unbearable injustice, burdened with an ugly weight of hate, forced to live with these shameful conditions. Anyone might be tempted to be bitter and to retaliate with hate. But if this happens, the new order is just duplicating the old order and repeating the cycle again and again and again. And I think I'm just going to give a little brief history lesson to illustrate that. There was probably no more oppressive regime in the old Europe that went into World War I than Tsarist Russia. The frustration was so great that it found there was an appeal to communist ideals and to overthrowing this old order. But you know what? The new order under Stalinist Russia was just repeating the same cycle. we could go on. I mean, this is just one example, but that's the point of what happens if this cycle continues, and hence the urgency of love. We've got to have both the strength and the humility of meeting hate with love. And of course, the old man will say, that's not practical. Life is really a matter of getting even, of hitting back, of dog eat dog. And we have to recognize, you know, there's a divine principle. It's a necessity that people need to learn lessons of reaping what they have sown. Okay, that's a necessity. If that necessity is passed over, it doesn't benefit the person who's done the wrong. So we're not trying to sound idealistic or impractical. This is a very practical, important thing for us to practice in our lives. And just remember that right now the world lieth in the wicked one. They're deceived. They're blinded, like Paul was. And of course, there are those who, like Satan, won't be moved. They won't want to become our friends, or of course he's judged anyway, but they simply won't be moved. The ones that are practicing terror today, they're of all stripes. They're not going to be moved right now. We know we're going to have to live with those practical problems, but to the extent that we can practice this love for our enemies and rebuild things, we're going to be showing this godlike quality in our lives. And that's the only way that hate will be overcome in the long run. We would like to think that love alone will bring things to a point where every man would come to appreciate God, but that's not the reality. And the scriptures show that it shall come to pass in that day, and that's our day, that there are going to be nations coming against Jerusalem that'll be destroyed. We find that in Zechariah 12:9. So simple kindness isn't going to be the solution for all of the problems. But having said that, there's an urgency for mankind, because man has been following this practical way of hate for too long. And it's just led to more confusion, more chaos, and more hate. You know, history's cluttered with the wreckage of societies that have surrendered to hate, that have surrendered to violence. And so for the help and salvation, not only of ourselves, but for our neighbors ultimately, we have to follow another way. And this doesn't mean that we're going to abandon our righteous efforts and look with faith for the time when the kingdom will make everything right. We're talking about something we need to be doing right now. Right now, our energy must be focused on living as Christ lived, and to show by example, not just by preaching, by example, how to rid the world of hate. We can't ever relinquish this privilege, this obligation we have to love. And while abhorring every hateful evil, we love our enemies. That's the only way to follow Christ's command. Love is the most durable power in the world. This creative force, so beautifully exemplified in the life of our Lord Himself, is the most potent instrument available in mankind's quest for peace and security. Napoleon Bonaparte said this, looking back over his years of conquest, "Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I have built great empires." But upon what did they depend? They depended on force. But centuries ago, Jesus started an empire that was built on love. And even to this day, millions will die for him. Who can doubt the veracity of these words? Well, brethren, I said I was giving this discourse for a special reason at this convention. And I said I would tell you the reason at the end. We are looking at tomorrow as the birthday celebration of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. The materials that I have presented here have been based on his discourse on the urgency of love in his book Strength to Love, published just a few months before he was assassinated. So when I looked at the schedule for the convention, I said, you know, I actually have something done by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And this was done for College Connections. I said, well, there's other things to talk about, but how often am I going to get a chance to actually do it on the holiday and to give you perhaps a sense you didn't have for some of the teachings that were urgent in his life? There's a lesson there for us, brethren, and may the Lord add his blessing.